You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of May, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent, joins us to set the agenda. What do you have for us today, Geoffrey?
We're going to visit Syria, we're going to look at money laundering, and we're going to go to France, where this afternoon they have, to the regret of many in France, their first same-sex wedding.
And it is the 60th anniversary of the first successful Everest ascent. We find out what it's like conquering the world's tallest peak and whether it's still even a challenge.
Once there was a mountain called Peak 15. Nothing was known about it. But in 1852, the surveyors found it was the highest in the world, and they named it Everest.
And who wants a bit of bubbly? Well, the Chinese do, if a move by their government to recognise the fizzy drink is anything to go by. We'll discuss what this move does for the celebratory tipple.
And we find out how independent gaming companies are being given the chance to release their products to a potentially massive audience.
Currently, App Store has tons of games that look like almost the same and play like almost the same. For us, it was really easy to stand out there if we just do something original and with high quality.
All that, plus we'll play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but first let's catch up with the latest world news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Rebel fighters in Syria have accused the anti-Assad coalition assembled outside the country. In a statement, they accuse them of failing to properly represent the Syrian revolution. It comes ahead of an emergency UN debate on Syria, and with arguments continuing between the US and Russia on whether to arm either side in the country's civil war. Christopher Phillips, an expert on Syria at Queen Mary University in London, told us there's little prospect of an imminent breakthrough.
It would be wonderful if it could be settled by purely domestic elements, but it's become hugely internationalised. Iran and its ally Hezbollah are heavily backing the Assad regime with support from Russia, whilst the rebels are backed variously by Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And that's one of the reasons why I'm quite sceptical that the decision by the EU to lift the arms embargo is actually going to be a game changer.
A man has been arrested over the stabbing of a French soldier near Paris at the weekend. The 22-year-old suspect was detained 30 miles from the city. Police sources say he was traced because of DNA left at the scene of the attack. Pakistan is condemning a US drone strike inside the country, which it's thought killed at least four people. It happened in the volatile province of Waziristan just a few days after President Obama defended the use of drones. It's not clear if those killed were the intended targets of the strike. Five people have been arrested around the world as US prosecutors accuse the operators of a digital currency exchange of helping criminals to launder billions of dollars. They claim Liberty Reserve's funds are linked to everything from child pornography to software for hacking into banks. The company's founder is among those detained in raids in the US, Spain and Costa Rica. Preet Bharara is the US attorney for New York's Southern District.
Liberty Reserve was intentionally created and structured to facilitate criminal activity. It was essentially a black market bank. As alleged, Liberty Reserve deliberately operated in a way to attract and aid criminals who wished to use digital currency to break the law and to launder the proceeds of their crimes.
And has ruled that a soldier killed an Italian journalist who was shot dead in Bangkok during anti-government protests 3 years ago. Fabio Polenghi was taking pictures of a military crackdown on the demonstration when he was killed. A lawyer for his family claims the court's ruling has directly implicated Thailand's prime minister and his deputy in the killing. In the US, President Obama has visited an area devastated by last year's Superstorm Sandy. A huge amount of damage was done, with many people left homeless. The president urged Americans to visit New Jersey's shoreline during the summer vacation season and said the area's progress sent a message of hope to people cleaning up after last week's tornado in Oklahoma.
when we make a commitment that we've got your back, we mean it. And we're not going to finish until the work is done, because that's who we are. We help each other as Americans through the bad times, and we sure make the most of the good times. So let's have some good times on the New Jersey shore this summer and next summer and the summer after that and all year long.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. It's 5 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Hugo MacDonald. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us in the studio today is a good friend of this program, Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Welcome to the program, Jeffrey. Let's begin in Syria, shall we? Lots of developments this week. The EU arms embargo being lifted, Russia sending anti-aircraft equipment to Syria, Hezbollah saying they want victory. It's such a mess, isn't it?
It really is. You know, I feel like I'm back in the 1970s and 80s with these proxy wars, the Soviet Union versus the U.S. and the West. What's happening in Syria this week is a real game of brinksmanship. The U.K. and France pushing through a change here in the EU, lifting the arms embargo, the UK and France considering arming the Syrian rebels, and Russia immediately responding, saying, we're going to send in these S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. Israel saying, you do that, we're going to start bombing them. It doesn't seem to be moving us towards peace, but this is a real high-stakes chess game that we're watching here. And it's all leading up to what we hope is a peace conference in Geneva in mid-June. The UK and France gambling that by threatening to arm the rebels, Syria will take it all seriously and will actually negotiate some exit to this. I'm skeptical. But I think it's a real worry for the region and for stability in the world.
Do you think we're going to reach the peace talks in mid-June without sort of dramatic developments beyond what we've seen this week?
Oh, I mean, I think it's inevitable these dramatic developments will continue. I think when you look at the fine print here, the Russians don't exactly have these S-300s on transports ready to go to Syria. It's going to take some time, by some reports, even a year. The Russians clearly incensed that the EU is going to arm the Syrian rebels. The U.S. is in an impossible position here because on one hand, they're condemning Russia for arming the Syrians, and yet they're not condemning the EU for arming the rebels. It's sort of, are they having it both ways? I think the real problem for President Obama and the U.S. is there's simply no appetite for owning another war. We've talked about this here before, but the U.S. just doesn't have the political will, the stomach, to enter with troops on the ground. And this is a much, much more complicated conflict than the one in Libya that I covered for ABC. You can't simply have an air war with NATO bombing and give the rebels a free passage to Tripoli, as we saw. And even that was complicated, bloody, and took much longer than expected. That just doesn't work, given the complexities and the military strength of the Assad regime in Syria. And the real concern is that the U.S. is going to go in tepidly, and that's just simply going to prolong everything. You're either in or you're out seems to be the clearest direction. I just see no scenario at this point where the U.S. Congress and the president will, though, go in all the way with troops. It just doesn't seem realistic. So I see this muddling on, a lot of people suffering and dying.
Another story, Jeffrey, that's caught your attention, this amazing story of money laundering, a huge amount of money.
Well, you know, this seems to be just this week's version of the world's financial system not being equipped to deal with the cyber universe. Last week, we talked about all this controversy about Google and eBay and Starbucks and others using and Amazon using the world, the cyber world, to just this side of legal, avoid paying taxes by basing themselves in places like Luxembourg and Ireland. This is completely different. This is dirty, but it uses the same computer system that the World Wide Web. Liberty Reserve, I think it's technically a Costa Rican company run by an American who renounced his citizenship. $6 billion in transactions, something like 55 million customers. And much of it, if you believe what the federal prosecutor in New York State says, is dirty money from drugs, from stolen, from cyber crimes itself. You name it. This has become the mechanism of choice for laundering money. And just to give you a sense of how easy it is, you just needed any name. Federal agents in the U.S. called themselves Joe Bogus. And they, when asked what it was for, they said for cocaine. And they moved money around. And there was no system within the Liberty Reserve to catch any of this. They didn't care. They just let anybody move money, whether it's from Cyprus to New York City or Moscow to the Cayman Islands, on a staggering scale, $6 billion. They've closed it down. And what's really interesting is that they're detecting all sorts of chatter on these online forums amongst criminals who are panicking, saying, where's my money?
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I know, the black market bank. But what about, presumably there must have been some people who were using Liberty Reserve who weren't criminals.
One would hope that some of it. But and they have said, if you have used it legitimately and your money is frozen, come to us and we'll deal with it. But they're very skeptical. They say that this has become really this is really all about giving people an anonymous way to move dirty money. Five people arrested, most of them in Costa Rica. But this operation reaches deep into places like Russia and Nigeria, where there's a huge amount of dirty money passing around.
Because there virtually is no regulation of this, and there's no way really to enforce this at all, which is just startling. But Jeffrey, just moving on to your third topic, later this afternoon in France, we will see that country's first gay marriage.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I find this fascinating. This is the 14th country, France, to approve gay marriage. And no country has faced the kind of opposition that we're seeing in France. You know, liberty, equality, fraternity, you know, I think in some corners, intolerance. In large corners, 150,000 people took to the streets yet again this past weekend to protest it. And we're not just talking about hardline Catholics. That is one of the main elements. But we're talking about social conservatives who are themselves quite secular. 150 French lawyers wrote to the French government saying that children won't be able to know their birth parents. This is a bad idea. You just didn't see that in the debate. In here in the UK, in Spain, in Canada, and even in the US, it tends to be an evangelical-based opposition. There is something about the makeup of French society today that we are learning through this debate that says much more than attitudes towards same-sex marriage, same-sex relationships.
And there have been some amazingly dramatic events as well. The historian, French historian Dominique Vénier, actually killed himself in Notre Dame.
In front of 1,500 tourists. It really is incredible. This, you know, France prides itself, even though it's a deeply Catholic country, in being a secular government. And this really is exposing a reality that says that the French have not abandoned their Catholic roots or separated themselves from their Catholic roots in governmental form as much as they might like to think.
Let's hope it doesn't impinge too much on the celebration of Vincent Hey, Bruno, who are getting married
at 3:30 GMT today.
Indeed. Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Thank you very much indeed, as ever, for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Horological showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
Coming up, we will set our sights on Everest as we mark the 60th anniversary of the first successful ascent. But first, to take us there, here's Public Service Broadcasting with Everest.
Once there was a mountain called Peak 15. Nothing was known about it. But in 1852, the surveyors found it was the highest in the world, and they named it Everest. When you're lacking oxygen, you may think you're normal, but you're not. You're moving in a dream that deludes and debilitates.
Was Public Service Broadcasting with their tune Everest. Now, the scramble to conquer the highest mountain in the world was the predecessor to the space race. 60 years ago today, it was achieved by Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Two experienced climbers, they made history, going where no men had gone before to reach the summit.
60 years on, reaching the top of the world has become a bit of a commercial enterprise, with traffic jams causing two-hour waits at the Hillary Step. That's the last hurdle to the summit. Westerners can pay anything from $10,000 to $100,000 for permits and guides to accompany them up the mountain, and a sizable tourist industry has sprung up around the base. Does this devalue Everest, not just the experience, but the mountain itself? And how sustainable can this mass marketing of the mountain be?
In a moment, we'll be joined by Graham Hoyland, author of The Last Hours on Everest and the 15th British man to climb Everest. But first, we have Pinjo Sherpa from the Saving Mount Everest Project and an experienced Everest guide on the line himself. Pinjo Sherpa, many thanks for joining us on the program. 60 years, the celebration today. Is it still just as special as it was 60 years ago?
Not really. Actually, the 60th anniversary just started about a few years ago. But this is more of a, like a government program which is celebrated in Kathmandu Valley.
Pinjo, tell us a little bit about what the Saving Mount Everest project is about and what your mission is.
Yes, Saving Mount Everest is a waste management project. As you know, the mountain was considered as a dumping place since many years. But many expeditions, they have been cleaning up the mountain along with the trekking areas in that area. But the accumulation of waste since 1953, it goes into crevasses, it gets covered by snow, and it surfaces because of the changing climate.
So the
cleaning up campaign always it goes on, but still you can see many waste on the Mount Everest.
So give us a sense then of the situation at Mount Everest now. You know, we've heard horror stories of the base camp being full of empty oxygen canisters, used tents. You know, some people have even seen fast food wrappers there at the base. How bad is the situation?
No, it doesn't. It is not like that as you hear right now. There are many media people, even local national media. It's much cleaner now than before. Since last 3-4 years, there's one organization called Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee. They get the responsibility to clean up to Camp 2. So they're doing quite a good job cleaning up the base camp and taking all the waste to Gorakhship, the nearest place where they can dispose it.
Pinjo Sherpa there from the Saving Mount Everest Project. Many thanks for your time there and happy 60th anniversary. Graham Hoyland, he's the author of The Last Hours on Everest. He joins us now on the line. Graham, we were just hearing there from Pinjo Sherpa. He says the situation there on the ground isn't so bad. Things are quite manageable. Would you agree with that statement?
Oh, yes, I would agree. And it's great to hear Pinjo's voice. It reminds me that none of us Westerners would get up Mount Everest if it wasn't for the hard work of the Sherpas. But I would say that the mountain's much, much cleaner than it used to be. All these clean-up expeditions are doing a great job. But, you know, talking about the difficulty, someone said once that all mountains go through three stages. First of all, it's an impossible peak. Secondly, it's the hardest peak in the Himalayas. And then the third stage, it's an easy day for a lady. And I'm afraid all mountains go through those three stages. And Everest, you know, it took seven expeditions of the British failing to climb Mount Everest before the Second World War, before it was climbed in 1953. And now an 80-year-old Japanese man just climbed it. A 13-year-old boy has climbed it. And it's become an easy day.
But Graham, we're hearing sort of horror stories of 2-hour waits to actually reach the summit itself, and someone described it as being like 5-lane traffic on bank holiday. Is that true, or is it a gross exaggeration? It surely can't be that busy.
Well, it's not a wilderness experience anymore, put it that way. I mean, it's more like a McDonald's experience than a wilderness experience. But, you know, I don't really mind this. I mean, look at Snowdon. If everybody wants to have a look at what mountaineering might be like, they can walk up Snowdon safely, lots of them. There's a cafe at the top. I don't see why Everest can't become like Snowdon.
Graham, before we leave you, you were the 15th British man to climb Mount Everest. Hugh and I were just talking before we came to you whether we would want to do it ourselves. I personally said I think it might be a bit too difficult for me and a bit too cold. I don't know about you, Hugh.
I said if they put a cafe at the top, yeah. I'd definitely be up there.
But just set the scene, Graham. Explain and describe just how magical it is and what it's actually like when you make it up past that Hillary step.
Well, it's wonderful up there. I mean, first of all, you had the wonderful experience of traveling through Nepal and meeting all the Sherpas, who are just wonderful people, I must say. And then on your summit day, you crawl out of your tent at midnight or earlier, and then you stagger up the mountain, pulling on ropes, and then you start seeing dawn coming up over on your right-hand side. And then as the sun comes up, you might pull off your oxygen mask and have a look around at the best dawn of your life. You'll struggle up the Hillary Step and then crunch up a few steps up to the dome that is the top of the mountain. It's no bigger than a dining table, but it is the most wonderful world that you'll ever see.
Well, Graham Hoyland, you've certainly painted a wonderful picture there. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. And thanks also to Pinjo Sherpa before.
Hugo, actually, I've changed my mind after listening to Graham describe that.
I know, that was lovely,
so magical, didn't it?
It did. I closed my eyes. I felt like I was on the summit of Everest.
Let's try and do it before year's end. Maybe next year. Now, it may be early in the morning here in London, but it's time to pop open the bubbly and toast the Chinese authorities who have just registered champagne as an official label in the country.
Up till now, the champagne name has been misapplied to any sparkling wine. But from now on, the name will be restricted to sparkling wines produced in the Champagne region of France. Controversy over the name gained importance as sales of champagne soared in China in 2012. Champagne exports to the Asian nation last year jumped 52% to 2 million bottles.
Now, winemakers from Champagne have spent years trying to educate consumers. Not all bubbly is champagne, and they have finally made a breakthrough in one of their fastest growing markets. Well, joining us on the line to discuss the significance of this announcement is Bloomberg's Andrew Roberts in Paris. Welcome to the show, Andrew. This really is quite a huge development and welcome news, I'm sure, for champagne makers.
That's absolutely right. It's interesting you mentioning that that China was one of the fastest growing markets for champagne exports. It's actually the fastest growing. And that's relevant because consumption in Europe and particularly France, France is the biggest market for champagne. It's about 100 times the size of that of China in terms of consumption, and that's actually slowing. So, growers are looking to Asia and particularly China to capitalize on sort of an emergence of a middle class there, but also demand for luxury in general to sell their wares. So by having protection on the champagne region and the products from the region, it gives them a little bit more brand power there and pricing power as well.
Indeed, I gather it hasn't been without controversy in China due to translation of the names. Andrew, do you know anything about this?
I can't comment on the translation of the names. I know that there is, in terms of generally how luxury is used there, obviously in the context of what the government's been doing, there's been some degree of clampdown on the use of the word luxury. There's been some degree of clampdown on various terms in general. And obviously translation is always an issue with product. And you have to understand as well that, you know, perhaps in Europe and the US and other parts of the world, people are more used to the idea of champagne, but culturally it's very new still in China, so that is obviously leaves it very open to interpretation from consumers who may be less informed perhaps about the product. I mean, you know, if you compare it to cognac, I think in terms of liters consumed, champagne was something like 900,000 liters were consumed last year. But if you compare that to cognac, which is has a lot of resonance in the country, I think over 25 million liters were drunk or at least acquired in China last year. So, you know, you're talking with two very, very different markets. And in terms of people's understanding of those drinks, champagne is still fighting a battle to sort of gain recognition.
And Andrew, that's an interesting point. You mentioned cognac there. And in many Asian countries, including China, prestige is a huge part of buying these luxury products. Does champagne have that same relevance and connection with kind of the prestige factor?
It does. And actually, if you look at some of the marketing tactics that some of the champagne growers have been using in China, I mean, they are They're using endorsements from local celebrities. They're sponsoring exclusive parties. I think they're trying to get consumers to associate champagne with sort of luxury in general, and to a degree the sort of play on the desire to show off, for want of a better expression. But it's still got some way to go by comparison with cognac. And I think, you know, just one thing to add on this, the interesting thing about champagne is once you open a bottle, you can't really keep it. Obviously, with cognac, you can keep it for a much longer amount of time. And also, in terms of showing off the bottle, if you're not actually drinking it in a glass, at least if you've got some, you know, in your, wherever it might be, on in your bar or in your apartment or wherever it might be, you know, basically, for you to display champagne, you have to have it. You can't have opened it. Whereas cognac is something that stays open and therefore is a bit more present, I think, in people's houses or at least in bars, and that gives it a little bit more recognition with consumers.
Absolutely, Andrew. We'll finish off our bottle here before the end of this show, that's for sure. Andrew Roberts, Bloomberg's Matt in Paris. Many thanks.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll discuss how independent gaming companies are finally getting their shot. We'll head to Australia to find out about an ongoing abuse inquiry, and we'll review this morning's Latin American front pages too. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Rebel fighters in Syria have issued a statement criticising the anti-Assad coalition, which has been assembled outside the country. They've accused them of failing to properly represent the Syrian revolution. That statement comes ahead of an emergency UN debate on Syria, and with arguments continuing between the US and Russia on whether to arm either side in the country's civil war. A man has been arrested over the stabbing of a French soldier near Paris at the weekend. The 22-year-old suspect was detained 30 miles from the French capital. Police sources say he was traced because of DNA left at the scene of the attack. A court in Thailand has ruled that a soldier killed an Italian journalist who was shot dead in Bangkok 3 years ago during anti-government protests. Fabio Polenghi was taking pictures of a military crackdown on the demonstration when he was killed. Lawyers for his family say the court ruling today has directly implicated Thailand's prime minister in the killing. Pakistan is condemning a US drone strike inside the country, which it's thought killed at least 4 people. It happened in the volatile province of Waziristan just a few days after President Obama defended the use of drones. And 5 people have been arrested around the world as US prosecutors accuse the operators of a digital currency exchange of helping criminals launder billions of dollars. They say Liberty Reserve's funds have been linked to everything from child pornography to software for hacking into major banks. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Phil Hahn.
In this week's Entrepreneurs, we're concentrating on the businesses behind games. We'll meet the founder of the largest Western-run game studio in Shanghai. We'll be in Australia to test out a legendary cricket ball maker. And we give the classic French pastime pétanque a brand overhaul with our friends at Wing Creative. But in this preview, we are heading to lovely Helsinki.
Smartphones and tablet computers have provided computer game fans with another more mobile way of playing games. Online shops such as Apple's iTunes Store have given newer, smaller, independent gaming companies the chance to release their products and get them exposed to a potentially massive audience. Mark Bosworth has been to visit Frogmind, a new gaming company, which has recently launched its first game.
Finland is well known for its lakes and forests, so it's only natural that a Finnish gaming company should decide to set one of its games in a forest. But this forest is full of sinister traps and obstacles which you need to navigate a furry creature through. Badland is the debut game from Frogmind, an independent Helsinki-based company set up in April last year by Johannes Vuorinen and Johanna Mundlus. So, Johannes, you're the programmer and designer here at Frogmind. Now, you and Johanna were both working for Redlynx, which is a large gaming company here in Helsinki. So, why did you decide to go it alone and set up Frogmind?
We have known each other for 5 years. I guess first, after 2 years, we already talked about starting our own indie studio. But at that point, we weren't 100% sure, so we decided to still go to work for someone else. We had these great projects. Johanna was working in Moto Heroes, and I was working in Trials Evolution. And they both projects finished in spring 2012. Then we thought again that, well, how about now?
What challenges have you faced so far with setting up the business?
Actually, things have gone really smoothly. Our marketing worked really well, and press got interested about the game really fast, and also players. We got like 50,000 views for our first gameplay video in YouTube. So yeah, things have gone really smoothly, I would say. So there haven't been like problems that we have faced. So
has it been a steep learning curve for you though?
Yeah, of course. Like neither of us have run a business before, so there were lots of new things to learn. But we are here at the startup incubator here in Aalto Startup Center. So here are a few guys who help us a lot to assist us in running business sides of things. So also the business side has been quite smooth, I would say.
Well, as Johannes just mentioned, Frogmind's office is based at Aalto University's Startup Centre. It's like a business incubator to help new companies develop. Johannes and Johanna were given 15,000 euros. They were provided with mentors, and they were also given this office, which we're now standing in. Now, Johanna Mulus is the artist and designer at Frogmind. Johanna, what are you doing at the moment?
Hello, I'm currently making some new strange creatures in Badland backgrounds.
And these are all to go into this wonderful fantasy-like forest where you play the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Badland was released at the start of April and it was featured in the Apple App Store. So how does a new unknown company get featured in the App Store?
Well, I think it's really simple answer, make interesting game. Currently, App Store has a tons of games that look like almost the same and play like almost the same. There are some really good games that aren't like that, but I think it's for us, it was really easy to stand out there if we just do something original and with high quality.
Now, the game was downloaded over 100,000 times in its first week. Were you expecting this?
I wouldn't say it was unexpected. I mean, we knew we had a good game, but there's always stuff that could happen. I mean, it wasn't sure if we're going to get featured or anything like that, and there are lots of good games over there. There could be some game that's like similar to us, but a little bit better, and everything could go wrong. But I wouldn't say it was unexpected, but we were still very happy about it.
The game's been getting very good reviews. The Guardian newspaper in the UK said that Badland was a marvellously crafted platform game with 40 striking-looking levels. It must feel good when things like that are said about your work.
Well, yeah, of course. It's like, I mean, we don't do this for good reviews. We do this just to please ourselves, do something interesting and have fun with it. But, you know, it's saying something like that, it's remarkable. So, yeah, very happy about it.
Well, Johannes and Johanna have told me that they've both gone without a salary since the start of this year in order to save their company money, but they did hire the services of an independent audio designer, and that's you, Jonas Turner, specifically for this Badland project. So how do you begin to think how a game like this will sound?
I personally like games that sound really interesting, like everything's happening. I mean, I saw this game, I was like, okay, there's like stones rolling around, circular saws, explosions, flying in a forest. I was like, no, this game has to sound interesting. Then I sat down with Johannes and Johanna, and we went through the concept, and their concept, what they heard in their mind, was kind of the same what I heard in my mind, and then we just ran with it.
And at the start of the game, players are advised to wear headphones to enhance the gaming experience. That's a really big compliment to the work you've done.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, if it was for me, I would just advise people that carry ghetto blasters and play the game loud on the train or bus. Yeah.
Has it been good fun to work on?
Yeah, really good fun. I mean, most of the sounds I recorded myself and edited myself and so on and so on and so on. And it has been a really nice trip making this game.
And that was Mark Bosworth there in Helsinki playing those games. And of course, you can tune in at 1900 hours London time, 11 o'clock in the morning, if you are in San Francisco, for more inspiring news and views of businesses around the world with the premiere of this week's Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24.
But you're listening to Midori House right now, where the time is 8:41 in London. We'll be back right after this with an update from our man in Melbourne.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Phil Hahn.
The time is 8:42 here in London, which makes it 17:42 in Melbourne, a Wednesday evening over there down under. Well, we're going to head there now to talk to our man, Patrick Pittman in Melbourne. Welcome to the show. Patrick, let's begin with some very harrowing testimony from the Cardinal George Pell, the country's most senior Catholic.
Yes, this is part of an ongoing inquiry into child abuse by not Catholics specifically, but religious organizations broadly. It's been going on here in Melbourne for a little while. It was called towards the start of last year. And it was pretty unprecedented in terms of this case in Australia. He said he was fully apologetic and absolutely sorry while admitting up to 620 Victorian children have been abused by the Catholic clergy in the past 80 years.
Saying sorry isn't necessarily enough, is it? And I gather that's been the reaction of most people in Australia too.
Yeah, very much so. There have been small amounts of compensation, and this is just part of a broader ongoing inquiry into this. This is a state-level testimony that Cardinal Pell gave this week, but there's also a national royal commission that's underway in which will probably face even more questions. And, you know, questions of financial restitution will definitely be on the table there. But again, these things can never particularly be enough. And that has been the broad response from both victims and analysts looking at what he said.
And in Cardinal Pell's testimony, he said that the abuse had become widespread because clergymen did not want to talk about the problem. Now, obviously, a system of cover-ups there. Is there a sense there, at least in Australia, that they're hoping to at least mend fences and change perhaps the ways of the past, especially with the new Pope Francis at the Vatican?
That's something Cardinal Pell likes to suggest. He really does think that things have cleaned up in the last decade or so. I think this is why it made such a it was such a surprise when last year in New South Wales there were revelations of ongoing cover-up and collusion between priests and police, which led to the formation of those royal commissions. But there is a sense that perhaps things have gotten better, but it does seem that the church still needs to do a lot of work as well. But Pell does seem to want to do that work.
Patrick, let's move on and talk rising tides in the islands. Tell us a little bit about this sorry tale as well.
So this week in the Pacific, in Rarotonga, in the Cook Islands, there's a meeting of many leaders to discuss displacement through climate change, which is sadly becoming a very urgent issue. But over in the Solomons and some of their outer islands, it's actually kind of gotten a little too late out in the Lord Howe Atoll and another one of them. It's looking like those people are going to need to be relocated pretty much now.
And can you give us a sense of the number of people that will have to leave and where exactly they plan on going?
So we're talking probably a couple of thousand people at the most. These are small islands. There's one larger one and then one with maybe 50 or 60 people on it. The premier of the province of the Solomons that those islands fall within has said that they can be relocated to the mainland of his province, but that's problematic as well and still needs government sort of work on their end. But all of these islands around there have been having discussions about where exactly all of these climate refugees can go. It seems that the main thing that most of these leaders want is to be able to keep these people within the Pacific and on these islands and keep this to something that the islands themselves can deal with. But you know, we'll see how long that can be the case for.
Well, Patrick, finally, let's end on some happy news that Australia has been ranked for the third year running by the OECD's Better Life Index, the best place to live. And we covered this in some detail last night. But as somebody living in Melbourne, we couldn't let you go without having your say on this.
On a Melbourne winter night like this one, I always find that a little bit difficult to believe. But it is, you know, particularly in terms of those things we're talking about, with some of that darker news coming out of the Pacific, cities like Melbourne do have it pretty good. And now this thing from the OECD, they're obviously looking at Australia's solid, you know, education, engagement in policy, really strong unemployment, and obviously, you know, our economy is still doing very well here as well. So those are the main things, and cities like Melbourne and Sydney are really thriving on a global level, and you know, you can feel that here as well. They're not particularly difficult cities to be in, which I think is what that survey is showing.
Yeah, unless you're an arachnophobic like me. Patrick Pittman in Melbourne, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Well, coming up, we get a roundup of today's Brazilian newspapers with our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
It does indeed make me quite envious, you know, speaking to Australians when they know what kind of life they're
I know, when
enjoying.
They moan about winter and you
it's
know
like 18
it's
degrees and sunny.
Exactly, warmer than our summer.
Oh, well. We'll have summer one day. One day. And of course, we will have a flip through this morning's Brazilian newspapers as well. But before that, we have some music to take us there. Here's a Tribalista with Yase Namora.
Thank you. paciência para a solidão. Eu sou de ninguém, eu sou de todo mundo e todo mundo me quer bem. Eu sou de ninguém, eu sou de todo mundo e todo mundo é meu também. Eu tô te querendo como ninguém, tô te querendo como Deus quiser. Tô te querendo como eu te quero, tô te querendo como se quer. Tô te querendo como ninguém, tô te querendo como Deus quiser. Tô te querendo como eu te quero, tô te querendo.
And that was Tribalistas with Yase Namura.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Phil Hahn. And joining us now for a run through of the Brazilian papers is Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Good morning. Did you enjoy the lovely song?
I did.
How do you pronounce it? Let's hear you pronounce it.
It's Yase Namorar.
Okay.
You were almost there.
The J is always a bit problematic in Portuguese.
Well, let's start with the Folha de São Paulo, Fernando, and good news from Africa.
Exactly. Well, since Lula was in power in 2002 and Dilma is from the same party, Brazil had kind of closer ties to Africa. And, you know, we have very close ties, of course, with Angola and Mozambique. We speak the same language. But now, actually, Dilma announced that she will cancel like $900 million worth of debt in Africa. So basically, she's going to forgive like 12 African countries, including Tanzania and Zambia. And it's interesting because she was there at the African Union Summit in Ethiopia. And it's the third... third visit in 3 months. That's quite a lot, actually.
So what's behind this? Is it all about economics? Is it bolstering trade ties between the African continent and Brazil?
Absolutely. And you know, the trade between Brazil and Africa increased like 5 times in the past decade. So, of course, there's like an economic spin to it. And and actually, it's interesting. During Lula's government, Brazil opened so many embassies in Africa as well. So, yeah, we're going to be the new China in Africa somehow. We're not quite there yet, but I think it's interesting to see this.
Staying on the Folha de São Paulo, news about Brazilian universities too.
Exactly. It's interesting that we put our own spin on it because, you know, the headline is, we have 4 out of the best, the 10 best universities in Latin America. And then you say, oh, so Brazil's doing quite well. But when you look, the best Brazilian university on the main list, like the best worldwide universities, we're only on the 139th position. Oh. And that's the Federal University of São Paulo, which is, I mean, it's a good university, but we're not quite there yet. For example, the British and American institutions, they're still the best. So I think we have to improve that quite a lot, actually.
Well, I guess when you're competing against, you know, institutions that have been around for more than 100 years and you're, you know, comparing it to Brazil, which is a fairly new country, it's a bit of a tough going. But what's...
Exactly, and it's funny because I think Brazil, we do like a little bit of research, you know, so I think, of course, we have one or two, like, very good universities, but, for example, I have to tell you, we have so many private universities, and the way they teach is quite awful, actually. They did a test recently, and, I mean, to be fair, they were not even supposed to be universities because they were not good at all.
And where are most of the students, then, that attend these universities? Are they Brazilian, or are you finding there are lots of people that are coming perhaps from Asia? You know, so many Asian students in places like here in London.
The number is increasing. I wouldn't say most of them come from Asia. Most of them come from Latin America, actually, from countries like Bolivia, Argentina, or Colombia. But I think we need to become a little bit more international as well. The vast majority are still Brazilian students. And it's interesting to know that the best universities are for free in Brazil, but then at the same time, they're very elitist. Because to go to be approved by one of those universities, you need to kind of go to a very good school because they're very difficult tests to get into, you know. So most of the, well, this is a generalization, but you know what I mean. Most of the poorer students, they go to private universities, which are quite expensive. So it is a bit unfair, the whole system, but, you know, we're trying to get there.
Fernando, I'm intrigued by this robbery in Rua Oscar Freire. Which is what Sao Paulo's equivalent of Bond Street.
Exactly. Where you stroll around, have a nice cup of coffee, buy some nice clothes.
Nice. Or maybe get your hair cut, which for these 20 people who were in this hairdresser.
Oh, might get robbed as well. Oh,
they
God.
Were all robbed at gunpoint. I mean, how this has made news in the Folha de Sao Paulo. Is it quite an uncommon occurrence nowadays?
Well, it's becoming more uncommon because, you know, I mean, we're discussing this previously. Sao Paulo, like 15 years ago, used to be one of the most dangerous cities in the world. It is not anymore, but I wouldn't say it's a safe city as well. So this case, I mean, it's becoming uncommon, but it's not, I'm not that surprised, to be honest. But it's just strange that, you're just there having your haircut, which, you know, Brazilians love to go for a haircut. Anywhere you go, there's a hairdresser, a pedicure, manicure. But yeah, it's quite a sad story. But this is still actually, it still happens.
So I guess it is like, frequently. What, New York's Fifth Avenue, LA's Rodeo Drive, and as Hugo said, kind of
Bond Street,
our Bond Street. On a street like that, in a city like Sao Paulo, is security a big thing? Will you find that outside most of these shops there are armed security officers? Are there bodyguards that you need to check before you even get into the front door?
There are, and it's quite... somehow it's an interesting experience when you are one of those streets in Sao Paulo because, you know, you still see, like, children asking for money. And it's quite sad, you know, I don't know. I have many feelings when I'm there. You know what I mean. Like at the same time, you're such in a privileged street, and you know Brazil's economy is booming. But you know, we still have quite a few problems with poverty and violence. But
well, staying on the topic of hair, but moving to O Globo.
Oh yeah.
there's a wonderful cartoon of Latin American political leaders highlighting their beautiful coiffed hair.
Exactly. So, well, you have many styles. You have Cristina's glamorous hair, you have Dilma's quiff, and Evo Morales kind of a little bit like a helmet style. But it's interesting because they're saying like, força na peruca, which is actually a Brazilian expression to power to the wig. But I can explain to you what it means. It means like, don't worry, everything will be okay. And actually this expression is mainly used kind of in the gay community, but everybody knows the meaning. So they just made a little joke of...
Everything will be okay so long as your blow dryer is in place.
As long as you have good hair, it's all fine.
And do you have any... Who's your pick for best hair?
Well, I mean, of course it's Cristina Kirchner. Of course. Absolutely. She's my number one. I like Dilma as well, but you know.
It's a bit of like, what, a beauty queen type hair, Kirchner's?
I like it. You know, there's not
it's
many...
very glamorous.
Not many political leaders like that.
And you're thinking Dilma's quiff is a little bit of last decade, maybe?
I think so. It's a bit 70s, South Soviet style. I don't know. It's not my cup of tea. I like her, but not
I'm
the
surprised
hair.
That Maduro's on this list, though. He's got a bit of an afro thing going on a bit.
Yes, it's funny hair, yeah.
It's a bit puffy.
Yeah, well.
Well, let's leave the hair aside. Monocle's researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed for taking us through those papers in Brazil.
And unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for in this edition of Midori House. Many thanks to our producers, Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney, our researcher, the very quiffed and talented Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Sophie Grove and myself will be back in Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Hugo MacDonald.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.